This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Barbara Bogave. And it's time now for your letters. That's the portion of our show where we match our listeners with a personal finance expert to help sort out their money problems. Today, author and journalist Carmen Wong Ulrich joins us from New York to talk with some of you. And Carmen, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Barbara.
So before we take calls, I would like to talk for a moment about immigration and jobs. President Obama, Washington, it's all about immigration reform right now. And of course, there's concerns about competition for jobs in an economy where so many Americans are unemployed. What should we be listening for in the debate to help us understand how immigration reform could change the job market?
Well, here's the thing. There's two conversations going on kind of simultaneously about this. And one is the job market specifically with tech, let's say, for example. So we're talking the highly educated, highly skilled, leaning towards, you know, software or science, STEM. And then we also have non-high school grad job market. Of course, the biggest conversation within the Latino community is mostly with Mexican or Latin American immigrants who come here undocumented, who work the fields, let's say. And what kind of competition is that? And I will say this, that the data points to, for the most part, Americans, since they have such command of the language, tend to go towards lower wage jobs that involve face-to-face interaction, like customer service. And those are jobs that many undocumented immigrants cannot get. So the competition isn't as strong as I think a lot of folks feel, and it tends to be very regional. But should things change, and should there be a path to basically having rights as someone who is either undocumented on their way to having some kind of work status, it really is going to make a big difference. And my feeling is in a good way. We've always had competition in this country. Isn't that what it's built on? You know, anyway, well, you can never escape the competition. Let's put it that way. And for the most part, what we see is, you know, specifically in Latino community, because I'm a part of it and an advocate for it, we see that the children of these immigrants assimilate, they get an education, and so many of them are on the college path. I'm the first in my family to get a college education, and I think that that's very important to realize. And then that the children of these immigrants really contribute to this economy.
Well, thanks for this. Now, are you ready to go to the phones?
Let's do it.
Great.
Those calls.
Well, first up, we have Ricardo calling us from Cincinnati. Ricardo, welcome.
Thank you, Barbara.
You wrote to us saying that you're a recent immigrant to the U.S., pertinent to our conversation. Where are you from originally?
I'm from Portugal originally.
Ah, so what kinds of money challenges did you run into when you moved here?
Getting into the U.S. credit system, that was a challenge. And I'd say somewhat frustrating, especially because when I came, I was working overseas before, so back in Portugal. I had a credit card. I had a loan on a house, and I came here, and that I went back to step zero. So my question really is, what would be the best way to break in?
You know, Ricardo, I'm thinking it's so ironic. My 15-year-old gets credit card offers daily in the mail, and it's doubly ironic that in our global economy that a credit history can't cross the pond.
It is, isn't it? It's really strange. Ricardo, the funny thing is that you work so hard and you do so well, and then you come up against something like this, which makes you feel like the 15-year-old who has no credit. You know, it's just that's how the system is pretty much set up. But I think that what you need to do is the same advice that I give to students just getting out of college, is in order to establish credit, use the tools that are available to you that actually don't give you real credit yet, but add on to your credit history. The easiest one is getting a secured card. And it's specifically called a secured card because basically you put down a security deposit. And then that is your line of credit. You use that responsibly, it gets reported to the credit agencies, and then eventually the secured card extends you credit beyond that security deposit, and you build your credit score and history with that. That's the way to do it with plastic.
Oh, so it's a way to create a paper trail.
Exactly. And you don't have to, you know, use it like crazy. Just use it responsibly, and you'll see. And shop around for free on sites like credit.com, bankrate.com, all of those sites that you can basically get a comparison and look out for fees, of course. Just make sure before you sign up that you call them directly and ask them, do you report to the credit reporting agencies? Now, the other thing, that there's one little bit of good news about credit reports is that now they're going to start looking more at things that are not tied to plastic. For example, your rent. paying rent on time. And this is really good news, especially for, let's say, students, people who haven't owned a home, that they are going to start reporting that, and that'll fall into your credit history. Because for the most part, if you're looking to buy a house and you don't utilize a lot of credit, you don't have much history. So in this way, it shows you're paying your bills responsibly.
Ricardo, does that do it for you?
Yeah, that helps. I must say, I did have that opportunity maybe to get the secured credit card, which actually took me quite a bit of time to find out about. But it just seems such a bad deal, you know, for, you know, someone that pays the bills on time. And it's like you say, it's even to get rent. And even after you rent an apartment, then it's difficult to get electricity connected or gas connected because you don't have a credit history.
Yeah, it's used to judge you and your responsibility. But I have to tell you this, Ricardo, it's hard to build it in the beginning. But once you get going, you've got it.
Ricardo, I hope you are awash in credit soon.
Be careful.
Best of luck to you. Yeah, use it well.
Thank you, Carmen.
Thanks for your call. Well, let's see what our other callers are up to. Katie is on the line from Decatur, Illinois, where she works as a part-time professor. Katie, welcome to Marketplace Money.
Hi. Thank you for having me, Barbara.
Well, so tell us, what do you do exactly?
Currently, I'm a part-time drawing professor at a private university, and I'm overwhelmed by my student loans.
How big a chunk of your income goes straight to paying off them?
A little more than half of my income.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty big chunk. And, you know, I moved back after I received my master's of fine art in 2007. I moved back to live with my family and then started teaching at a private elementary school. And I've been working part-time ever since. Usually I have two to three part-time teaching jobs at a time. And so I've just, you know, I've been struggling to make make my payments, and my parents have been wonderful. They've been supporting me the whole time. I've been living with them, and that's the only way I could pay back my student loans so far.
Well, Carmen, so what resources are there out there for
Katie?
Well, Katie,
first I have to ask if these are federal or private loans.
I have actually one private loan. My other loans are from Sallie Mae.
Okay.
I have about $40,000 in federal and the rest is private.
Well, thank goodness for that.
Yeah.
Because that's the good news. With federal student loans, I can't tell you how much of a fan I am simply because they are the most flexible in terms of being able to pay them back. Also, you have the option of forgiveness. The private loans, I am sorry to say, my dear, there's not much you can do with that.
Right.
Those loans are very inflexible. You can't file for deference or forbearance or forgiveness. You can talk to your private lender, explain your situation, let them know what your income is, see if they could restructure the loan. But in terms of the federal loans, there's a couple things you can do. One is the income-based repayment program. And this is the program that was just put into effect by the Obama administration last year that basically allows your monthly payments to reflect your discretionary income. So you're saying it's half your income right now. So it would go down to 10% or less of your income.
Imagine that, Katie. Just take a breath and imagine that.
I'm just trying to get it all paid off. They're, you know, I just want to be done with them. You know what I mean?
That's a trade-off. You know, yes, you're going to extend the term payment of the loan, right?
Right.
The term's going to be longer. You're going to pay more. But
right.
You do need to start working because don't forget, the years that you're not able to concentrate on building your credit, for example, or building your own life cost you in other ways. Or you can get it forgiven. You mentioned you worked in private school. If you worked in the public sector, if you taught, after a certain number of years, though, some of those balances can be forgiven, completely gone.
Okay.
So think about that, because that could be a lot of money. So you want to talk to the federal loan administrators that you have and say, here's the community college I'm looking at. Does it qualify? How many hours do I have to put into it? And a 15-minute phone call can put you on the path to getting thousands of dollars just gone.
Okay.
Oh, Katie, I wish you so much luck.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Carmen and Barbara.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, let's see. Who else do we have lined up? April is on the line now from, right here in Los Angeles. Welcome, April.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a big fan of the show.
We're lucky to have you. And I understand you're starting to think about estate planning. So what's on your mind?
I am. My husband and I started a family recently, so we thought that it would be a good time to get our legal affairs in order. And we wanted to set up a revocable living trust. We have very few assets, and we were wondering if we needed to go through a lawyer to do this or if it was safe to use one of the online services like LegalZoom.
Mm-hmm. I think I hear one of your assets right there.
The best asset of all.
How old is your child?
He's 15 months.
Oh, lovely. So you're really thinking seriously about this. I do have a question before we turn this over to Carmen. Do you already have a will?
No, we don't.
Oh, interesting. That's interesting you're thinking of a trust before a will, but I'll leave that to Carmen. And I do want to say I'm very curious about your answer, Carmen, because when my husband and I had our first child, I set up a will with LegalZoom.
Yes.
And they were a really new company then, and I always wondered if it had any legal legitimacy at all. I felt I could have gone just as well written a will on a napkin and corked it in a bottle and gone to Atlantic City.
I know, Barbara. No. Actually, you know, LegalZoom and Nolo.com as well, yes, they both, especially if you don't have a lot of assets and you don't have a complicated estate. Let's say you're not a business owner, you're not looking to inherit a lot from family, you don't own a bunch of properties. Those things will hold just fine. But here's the thing, you need the will. More importantly than that trust, and I'll tell you why, because the will is what takes care of your child. Now, basically, if you don't have the will and anything happens to you guys, a judge who's a stranger is going to decide where your child goes. So, and I know you mentioned 15 months. I tell people, do this when you're pregnant. Like, just get it done and really set this up as soon as possible. I would say just, you know, the second you hang up, go on the site, get the will done. It's really inexpensive. And basically, that's a directive about your family. But for you, you said you don't have a lot of assets. The trust is useful to set up basically so that the assets that you do have, you can have a directive as to where they go. So I always advise people, especially in the beginning, just get both. Get the basic will, get the trust, and of course the living will and the living directive as well. You want to make sure it's there.
Okay, perfect.
Basically, the more protection you can have, the better. And as you grow and as you build assets and you know, may you be blessed with a very fruitful life, then you want to look into having something more formal. And I definitely advise that you and your husband have separate wills and separate trusts.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
I hope that helps out, April, and good for you for being a great parent.
Thank you.
He got the last
We got
word
a goodbye.
Carmen, that is all the time we have for calls this week, I'm sorry to say. It was great hearing your advice, though, for our listeners.
Thank you so much. Those are great questions.
Carmen Wong Ulrich is a personal finance journalist and the author of a number of books, including The Real Cost of Living. And thanks again.
Thank you.